CliffCentral.com.
Cliff Central Revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
Do you have a domestic worker gardener? Do you pay them a minimum wage? How about a living wage? Do you know the difference? I certainly didn't, but our guest today introduced us to the practice. We have Nigel Branken with us today, and while in some cases race shouldn't matter, it certainly does with him and his family. Nigel moved his wife and six children to the inner city suburb of Hillborough in Joburg, post-democracy. He did this as a stand in solidarity to those facing extreme poverty, because the fact is, we cannot change what we do not see. They live by the principle that they must become friends to their neighbors and then become good neighbors to their friends. When Nigel first explored the idea of paying a living wage, he ended up realizing that he wasn't paying nearly enough for his domestic worker, Lois. Is that how we say it?
Yeah.
Lois. And her family to live in good health, safety, and with future promise, which is unfortunately the lot for more than half of our country's population today. Looks like there's no such thing as previously disadvantaged yet. Let's get into it with Nigel, and he'll explain it further. Hi, Nigel.
Hi, everybody. So great to be here.
Very, very good to have you. Hi, Mbali.
Hi.
I finally said hi to
you. I know. I thought you were going to do what you usually do. I feel like a piece of furniture sometimes.
Yeah, I panic, and then I don't greet you.
Hi, hi. Nigel, it's so awesome to have you. Literally, like, we've been looking forward to it for a good minute now. Yours is such an exemplary and an instructor story. Mm. So, thank you.
And, I mean, I'd like to actually point out, it's taken us this long to get his story because he's been working with a guy named Napoleon, or Napoleon's been arrested on false charges of murder. Yeah. he's very, very active in general in terms of, you know, acts of injustice
Napoleon
that happen.
I don't know if you'd like to.
Yeah, Napoleon is a good friend of mine. I've known him for, I'll say good friend, but we've known each other just 2-3 years now. So it's quite a new sort of getting to know him. But he's an activist in Marikana, and he's really been standing up for that community. He moved into that community also to live in solidarity with people there. I think he... a lot of the issues in Marikana, I suppose, are very relevant to this show as well.
Yeah.
So mine workers not getting paid a living wage, that was really what the massacre in 2012 was about. And still to date, we don't have those people who were involved in the massacre haven't been brought to account.
Yeah.
Although there's been the Commission of Inquiry, and of course the NPA has been involved. So Napoleon's been arrested together with a whole lot of other activists on sort of trumped up charges of murder. We've had evidence that he wasn't there. He was with journalists. He was there's video footage. There's photographs of him at another place. But these things don't seem to matter to a state that is intent on targeting activists and using state resources to ensure that voice is not heard. So he's in jail, and I've been trying to get him. He's been in jail today for by the time the show airs, he'll have been in jail for 44 days.
Wow.
Still on his bail hearing. A bail hearing normally takes 15 minutes.
My goodness.
And it's day 15 of his bail hearing. But the Oscar trial, I think, was shorter than his bail hearing.
That's unreal.
It's not funny. It's really sad that...
But do you think that's deliberate on the part of...
Oh, it's been absolutely deliberate. We've seen them...
Institutions.
You know, so you'll go to court, and then they'll hold... you'll arrive in the morning, you know, normally court starts at 9 o'clock, and they'll call the case at 3:45.
Oh.
And then you'll sit, and the magistrate will say, sorry, there's not enough time to hear this case today, let's postpone it. So we're going back on Thursday and Friday this week.
Mm.
So I think the show is on Thursday, so we'll be going back on Thursday to support him, and again, call for his release, and taking more evidence that he couldn't possibly have been there. We've had journalists who were with him at the time when this murder was committed, and we have testified to say he wasn't there, you know. But it seems it doesn't matter much evidence we bring. I think it's very intentional, you know. I think Marikana, it's over 100 years, almost 100 years of these mines that have become some of the wealthiest companies in the world.
Yeah.
And people in Marikana continue to live in abject poverty. So there's another mine just up from Lonmin called the Tarisa mine.
Mm.
And there was a community that was moved from that for that mine to be based there. And that community is now living, they were formerly living in brick houses, they're now living in shacks. There's no schools, there's no amenities for that community. So Napoleon's been standing up and calling for Tarisa mine to fulfill its obligations in terms of the mining charter. It's also Lonmin as well. Anyway, we can get into this for a long time. But
I mean, before Talisa goes ahead and we get into the discussion, what I'd really like to know, you seem called, in a sense, to address these types of issues. I mean, we'll talk now about economic injustice, but it just seems something in you is an activist and a civil society leader. And so I would just like to know about your early background and kind of what led you here.
So I'm that white guy they don't tell you about. I really was on the other side of the system, you know. So, and I grew up in, I went to an all-white school. I got a privileged education. And it's all part of a journey. And I think South Africa, we've got to take people on journeys. And I know that the last couple of years, we've been on some journeys together as a nation to rediscover what it means to be South African, and revisiting some of the deals that were made in 1994 and the implications that of what we're living in now.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, for my early days, I studied social work.
Okay.
And that kind of got me into it. But, you know, I got married and then realized I needed to provide for my family. And so I started doing project management work, and soon I was working for doing consulting work and earning a whole lot of money, and we had a six-bedroom house in Midrand, and and we realized we were just completely divorced from the realities of West South Africa. We had two cars, we had, you know, the whole deal, kids in private schools, and realized we don't know our neighbors. We're living in a country where that was 7-8 years ago. You know, 57% of South Africans living in extreme poverty, highest inequality ratios in the world, and looked at that and realized, man, we are part of this problem.
Yeah.
And the more we look at, yeah, I think that, I mean, both Trish and I, my wife Trish, we talked about, we don't want to live in a world that looks like this in 20, 30 years' time. And what do we need to do to confront that? So, I'm going to say something very controversial, but anyway, I think the role of white South Africans is, at the moment, I think white South Africans need to commit class suicide, that we've actually got to give up our privilege. And when we give up our privilege, we've then got to move into communities to stand in solidarity
with
those communities until we see the back of extreme poverty and inequality broken in South Africa. So that, for me, would be my message to white South Africans. But I'm a white South African, so I can speak to white South Africans. To say white South Africans need to commit class suicide, I know probably lots of your listeners are going, oh no, there's another completely crazy radical.
No, well, you already said that you're the white guy they don't tell us about.
There's a reason.
There's a reason why.
But I do think, you know, I mean, I don't know if it was like this for you, but I think all of us, we start out, we earn a little bit when we start out, then we earn a bit more and we live off a bit more, we earn a bit more, we live off more, we earn off more, we live off more.
Absolutely.
Until eventually the circle that we're living off is just so large and completely out of context, you know, with, they say that the top 10% of South Africans, the richest 10%, earn 80 times more than the bottom 10%. Mm. I mean, there's something fundamentally wrong with it. That's not even a CEO to worker ratio.
Yeah.
We were in the UK recently, and they've just gone up to a ratio of, I think it's about 120-1 CEO to worker ratio. And they're saying that's absolutely insane. South Africa's CEO to worker ratio is sitting at 540-1.
Wow.
The highest in the world. Our CEOs are earning on average $7.4 million per year. Seventh highest paid CEOs in the world.
Get out of here.
This is in South Africa, and now we're talking about domestic workers, and you know, the our two richest South Africans, what's his name? Rupert and Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
And Visa, they're kind of neck and neck, yes. 6.7, 6.8, and 6.9 billion.
The LaRue's also somewhere.
Dollars, yeah.
Are you there as well, Molly? So, if you look at their, just the top two's combined income is equivalent to the bottom 50% of South Africans.
Mm.
That's just two. You take the 16 wealthiest South Africans, four and a half times the bottom 50% of South Africans. 16 people have got the equivalent wealth to 22, 25 million.
Okay, so that is an illness. That is literally a social illness. So when you say something like class suicide, I don't actually think you're exaggerating.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that it's gotten worse. Can you elaborate on that? Do you have ideas on why?
So, I mean, I do think, we weren't going to be talking about this, but anyway, let's go for it. So,
no, we feel right about that. Yeah. You broke the ice.
This is the whole show, actually.
Okay, so I mean, you talk about these issues. So we go back to 1994, and we look at the deals that were made in 1994. So we had, for example, we took the IMF loan.
Mm.
And when we took that IMF loan, there were certain conditions put onto our economy in terms of the way the economy would be managed. Mm. So we've had GEAR, ESGISA, that have all neoliberal kind of economic strategy. What is neoliberalism? Neoliberalism, I'm not an economist, but let me give you the 20-second, what is neoliberalism? It's when we outsource the public good to the private sector, or we entrust the private sector with provision of services, etc.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I think that we've put the problems in South Africa have been around our collusion between business and government.
Yeah.
And we've left civil society completely out of the picture, out of the mix.
But at that time, was that their only option? Because before, if you had a government working for the 10% and now having to work for the extra 90%, was there actually public capacity?
I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, I grew up, 94 is when I was, I would have been 23 at 94.
Mm.
So that was when I was young and dreaming. And that's essentially why I am who I am, is because 94 shaped me. I was, 1988 is when I finished school. Those 4 or 5 years of my life were dreaming of a new South Africa and what it could be like.
Mm.
So I was, Nelson Mandela was my hero.
Right.
I had a photo op with Cyril Ramaphosa. And
oh dear.
I did that.
Sorry about that.
I thought he's the man, and fast forward 20 years into our democracy, what is that trajectory taking us on? And we see the deals. We had the primary listings of Old Mutual and Sanlam moving to London. We had that capital and the wealth that had been built up in the country now is controlled from somewhere else. It's just crazy.
I guess when you mention someone like Cyril Ramaphosa, who, you know, was a civil society leader, he was leader of COSATU, right?
Yeah.
And someone like that then becomes, for a long time, squarely a businessman, right? And then, okay, Lord knows what's happening now. But my point is, your question was around, was there capacity? My question is around, was there intent?
Mm.
Because if you
How did he become a billionaire so quickly?
Exactly.
Yeah?
And then if, and look, you know, human beings are, all human beings are flawed and we're driven by self-interest. But I wonder if there was a shift in intentions, not from the white government, but from black leadership, when things like BE were dangled as carrots in their faces. I mean, people talk often about how BE actually was a white capitalist policy.
Yeah.
Right? It was intended to create a buffer between leadership and the public.
Yeah.
So I want to know from you, do you think there was intent? Do you think there is intent?
I'm not privy to what actually happened, you know, and that's the thing is we can see the fruit of these things and we can see what's happened, and we have, I mean, it certainly seems from the outside that, I mean, how is it possible that a man who who was a trade union leader,
like is now a billionaire. Polar opposites.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what puts Marikana at such, that brings all sorts of things into question, because this trade union leader is now the one that's negotiating on behalf of the company and tries to criminalize the strike action. I mean, it's just insane that anybody would think that somebody with that knowledge would not know that this is a right. And that's a right that he was involved in drafting in the Constitution in 1994. So he was one of our principal drafters. So he would have known very well what labor rights were. He probably was right at the front with his trade union background at negotiating that stuff. So for him to now come in 2012 and now say, you know, so I don't.
That's not even a crisis of conscience. That's just weird.
It's crazy what's happened.
Weird is polite.
I mean, what happened in Marikana is for me, it's bringing these things to a head. You know,
yeah.
So I mean, the South African rand and how we've opened up exchange controls and been able to, so many of these big companies are now the mines. So, for example, Lonmin, at the Farlam Commission, we heard about how they're practicing transfer pricing.
Mm.
And you know what transfer pricing is, where they take the platinum and they sell it in a tax haven at a lower price.
Hmm.
I mean, this is, you know, again, not a very quick explanation, but they sell it at a lower price to a tax haven and then sell it from that tax haven at the international market price. So in other words, what then happens is in South Africa, they declare that they haven't been making these massive profits, but their international companies,
just transferred them.
The profits are made outside of the country in tax havens, and our wealth is literally being transferred out via these tax havens. And these people are now running off with
our
mineral resources. So, yeah, South Africa's in a little bit of a mess. Which goes, I mean, to be honest, I'm just I'm an individual. I'm broken. I grew up as a white South African. I was part of an oppressive system. My whiteness still matters in South Africa, and the question for me is, how do I live authentically?
Yeah.
And what's the right thing to do? And if we ask that question, what is the South Africa I dream of? I dream of a South Africa that's equal. I dream of a South Africa where people are treated with dignity and respect. Where one day I dream of a country that is, where the color of your skin doesn't determine your life and your trajectory, and whether you go to college and whether you go to, you know, what kind of education you get, what kind of job you get, but the South Africa I live in now doesn't look like that.
No,
so,
not at all.
So the question for me is, how do I become the picture that I dream of? When I talk about class suicide, I think that it is about beginning to say, how do we live off less? You know, Mother Teresa, she used to say this, she'd say, live simply so others can simply live. And the reality in South Africa, Gandhi said this, you quoted Gandhi earlier, he said, there's enough for everyone's need, but not enough for everyone's greed. And we're living in a South Africa where we have such extreme poverty. We're an upper middle income country, according to the IMF and World Bank. They've classified as upper middle income.
Because of the extreme wealth.
Because our per capita income is just so large. We've got a huge GDP per capita. So as a country, we've got enough to meet the needs. So most international funders are now withdrawing from South Africa. So when you look at civil society in South Africa, it's part of the reason why we're so weak is because we're such a wealthy country. But the problem is most of our wealth is in the hands of so few. And I think that if I were to describe South Africa, you know, I was talking in the car on the way here to a friend and was saying, I suppose your life is about confronting capitalism. I said, well, capitalism was never meant to be this.
No, it wasn't.
If you read the fathers of capitalism, Adam Smith and stuff, they talk about this, the common good, and they talk
social
about
social responsibility
these,
is huge.
Yeah.
Adam Smith is big on that,
But for me, what it's become is it's become oligarchical cronyism, if you like.
And it's not sustainable. And I think I don't question that Adam Smith was a capitalist, but he wasn't necessarily even a capitalist with a conscience, right? But he understood sustainability and social cohesion and social justice is such an important part of economic sustainability.
Yeah.
If you want wealth to last, if you want, you know, you need the political climate to be right. You need the social climate to be right. And those are things. And, you know, for me, what I would like to appeal to is just, if not people's consciences, right? You know, say businessmen are too far gone, just their smarts in terms of economic sustainability. And this is not, for me,
self-preservation.
Exactly. This is not viable for future generations at all. Mm. But I think we should get into.
Well, actually, it's not completely off topic.
Just to say, so there's an IMF study that was done. And that was in 2015. And they looked at 159 countries. 159 countries, about 184, 185 countries in the world. So that's a significant percentage of the countries. They looked from 1980 to 2012. And they said that if you give a 1% increase to the top 20 quintile, you get on average a 0.38% decrease in GDP growth. So in other words, when you increase the income to the top 1%, to the top 20% by just 1%, you decrease the overall growth in the economy.
Wow.
When you give a 1% increase to the bottom 20%, you get an increase of 0.08% in GDP growth. So if we want to grow our GDP, we have to put more money into the bottom of the economy. That was a study over 30 years, 159 countries. How do you grow the GDP? What is
business sense?
Is the neoliberal agenda tell us? It says how you grow our GDP is to make it business friendly, create safer rules for businesses, to create less restrictions for them to exploit the poor. And what happens is they get richer and richer and richer and richer, and the trajectory that we've been on for the last 20 years in South Africa, our Gini coefficient in 1990 four was sitting at about 0.55. It's now sitting at 0.65 to 0.69, depending which data you look at. So we've become, I mean, it was 2006 at its height. I think we have, over the last sort of 10 years, begun to address it a little bit. But Gini coefficient is a measure of inequality. So the trajectory that we've been on is a more unequal society. And if we're going to change it, the topic at hand of domestic workers and not just domestic workers, but minimum wage generally is absolutely vital. Tackling minimum wage, creating a living wage for people is vital to transforming our economy and creating equality.
So what you say certainly debunks the myth that the economy will crash if the minimum wage is increased, you know? But just explain to us, what is a living wage?
So there's different definitions of living wage around the world. Maybe to start, maybe I could just start with minimum wage, because I think that's what people are most familiar with.
Yeah.
Minimum wage is a legislated wage base.
Which I loved that you wrote actually in your article. Like to actually bring it to that is actually very thought-provoking.
What I did with our own, with Lois, was we... See, even the way that I talk, you know, what I did with our Lois, she doesn't belong to me, you know. And it's something that has been so ingrained in us as South Africans, you know. We say things like, oh, she's part of my family. Is she really part of your family? Is she, does she have an inheritance? Is she going to share an inheritance to you? You know, but anyway, we've got to undo our language a bit, you know. She was working for me, and... I got a dietitian and nutritionist to help me with purchasing for her over 3 months what she needed for food. And back then, we couldn't get less than 2,000 rand a month for her family of four to meet all of her RDA requirements. You know, Stats SA use this food poverty line, and they look at the, I think it's 1,200 kilojoules a day that you need to survive. But that's just kilojoules. And then they talk about this concept called hidden hunger, where you're not getting enough nutrients to develop. So you find yourself tired. You find brain development is – there's challenges with that. I mean, every single one of these five areas of food, shelter, clothing, basic needs, and things that will break you out of poverty, we could talk for hours on each one of these. But essentially what we did was we looked at all five of these areas and we said, okay, well, shelter, what do we need for dignified shelter? And again, you know, if you look at South Africa and our housing crisis, my view is that mom and dad must have their own room. We can't be sitting in a situation in Hillbrow where I live.
It's a little bit perverse.
People will have a flat.
Yeah.
And that flat will be divided into 4 or 5 rooms.
Yes.
And each room will have a family inside of it. Mom, dad, and kids all together in one room.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think that that's dignified. I think that we've got to have a situation in South Africa. We've got to move towards making sure that people who work for us, that mom and dad can at least have their own room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then there's other... So what is that going to cost, you know? And I think, you know, currently in the inner city, if you're looking at a 2-room place, you're looking at least 4,000 rand, you know.
Are you serious?
For a room in the inner city. People
oh,
rent
the
rooms.
Room only.
Room only people will rent for between 1,500 and 2,000 rand a month. That's just one room.
Wow.
So if we're looking at 2 rooms for mom and dad and also the kids, which still is not dignified.
Yeah.
It's going to cost a lot more than that, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's actually touch a little bit on that, because if you're dealing with the larger issues around shelters, so, you know, proximity as well to infrastructure, safety in the neighborhood, all those kinds of things, access to resources for like water and electricity, and then you have a family that maybe is themselves struggling or just, you know, not earning enough to be able to afford a living wage, then how do we what do you decide is more important, you know? How do you then narrow down to what is a basic need?
Well, yeah, I mean, normally these things are prioritized by the family themselves who are getting the wages and
a family being the employers or a family being
the person that's trying to pay a living wage.
Yeah.
So the employer.
So the employer's family, yeah.
Right.
Well, I think I don't think that necessarily you're going to be determining for your worker how they're going to spend their money. You pay the worker a wage, which you think is fair, and the worker then determines how they spend their income. So I think that those things get determined by what somebody's earning and how they're going to live off that.
Are you asking if they can't afford that themselves?
Mm. Yeah, so
how can they be expected to pay that
to
somebody else?
Yeah, but I'm sort of so I'm imagining, so say they do like you did and you sit down with your domestic worker, you work all of this out, you realize
they need 7,000 rand a month.
Or say they need 5,000 rand alone just for shelter, right? So that they're in a place that is safe, so that they have easy access to public transport, all those kinds of things, right? So that's a part of your calculation. And you realize that that's just not something you can afford. What is, like, how do you determine then what,
you know, really hard.
Do you determine whether you can reduce that amount and you might maybe sacrifice your
maybe
safety?
Let's say you've now decided you're going to, you want to now pay a living wage and you're sitting there and you're saying, well, I can only afford 3,000 rand a month or 4,000 rand a month.
Mm.
What I would do is I would sit with the employee and I would say, I would work out what they need in order to live. And I think most studies are now showing could have sort of between 6,000 and 7,000 is round of where living wages at the moment.
Mm.
But essentially it's based on the individual employee. If it's a single woman and she's not going to have the same expenses as a person who's got maybe 2 kids or a family or whatever, you know, so we need to look at what's required to live off.
Yeah.
But let's say that a person needs 6,000 and you can only afford 4.
Mm.
Essentially, you can only afford to employ them for 2/3 of the time.
I absolutely agree with that. And I always feel like the issue is that we monopolize their time.
Yeah, completely.
Do you know what I mean? So, and I suppose the crisis of conscience is, should you have a domestic worker if you can't afford one?
Yeah.
But it's also not that simple.
Yeah.
You know, because of people's lifestyles, the immense amount of stress and pressure that they're
exactly,
under. And they're
exactly.
Needing.
So that's what I'm saying. That's always the crisis. And I suppose, you know, in an ideal world, you'd be proactive to say, look, if I can't, and we've heard of employers who have done this, right? If I can't afford to give you what you need, first of all, how do I not monopolize your time? And secondly, how do I try to find alternative ways or work for you to supplement that?
I think that the kind of things you can do is to reduce the number of days that a person works for you. So if you can only afford 3,000 and they need 6,000, you can only afford to pay to employ them for 2.5 days a week.
Yeah,
yeah.
that might, if it's in the area of childcare, for example, and you need somebody for childcare, and you can only afford R2,500 a month, maybe you need to get together with some friends, and then together, two or three of you, make sure that you can pay 6,000 rand. Yeah. So there are ways to, but the bottom line is, you can't pay somebody less because you think that you're just giving them employment. What you're actually doing is you're exploiting them, and let's be honest about that. If you exploit somebody, you're shortening their life expectancy, you're keeping their kids in poverty, you're making sure that they live under deplorable conditions, and that's what you're doing to a person. So it's not poverty that's doing it to them, it's you as the employer that's doing it to them.
And I mean, it's such an interesting thing because in our country, we know that there's quite a high percentage of unemployment. And so I think it definitely has contributed to that idea that, you know, you're doing someone a favor if they have a job. but how do we start holding, if at all, is that possible to start holding people accountable to the quality of life that they provide the person? I mean, where do we begin?
Yeah. I mean, I think South Africans are, we value driven. You know, we've fought for the struggle. Everybody knows the Constitution, and we all know about this. The core things in our Constitution are we believe in dignity, human dignity. That's at the center. Mm. All the other rights flow from that. You know, we believe in the right to life and the right to dignity. And if we believe in those things, every South African you talk to, doesn't matter if they still employ somebody in an exploitative way, their eyes open up when they realize that they are contributing to shortened life expectancy or these kinds of things. And I think we've got to appeal to conscience, but then I also think the second thing, an important thing, is we've got to advocate for an increase of the universal minimum wage. So, you know, when we talk universal minimum wage, currently in South Africa we've got sectoral wage determinations. And those sectoral, so we've got, for example, an agriculture, domestic work, mining, etc. Now, those sectors that have got sectoral determination account for 57% of all workers. 43% of all workers are not covered under the sectoral determination. So that means about 2.85 million people in South Africa are unprotected without any minimum wage legislation. Fortunately, domestic workers are covered. But even
so,
as you read earlier, so we've got to, I think we've got to argue for universal minimum wage, and we've got to equip ourselves with the arguments.
Sure.
So when you talk about universal minimum wage, people say, oh, that'll be a disaster for the economy. We actually quote, every single study that has been done, aggregate studies that have been done, aggregate studies are studies of studies.
Yeah.
So aggregate studies that have been done have showed that investing into the bottom of the economy results in overall GDP growth. And the reason for that is suddenly there's disposable income into the economy. When you put more money into the bottom of the economy, you create jobs.
Yeah.
Not just jobs. So you put more money into the hands of the poor, you
Productivity.
You create food, you create jobs in food, you create, you know, childcare jobs. People can now afford to do things in their communities, and that money just gets recycled. When you put money up at the top, the money gets spent on things like investments. It doesn't go into the hands of the economy. Is that what you spent your life increase on?
In my past life as an Oppenheimer. but anyway, I actually am very curious about the other three cogs. So you spoke about the first two being food and shelter.
Clothing. So, I mean, again, clothing is an interesting one. So I just need to say on shelter, I was very aware that I was speaking to an architect town planner. It was very apparent there. All of those things.
It show.
Definitely, you don't show. You don't hold back.
Article after I've spoken to you. I think that looking at what dignity is in that lived environment is important, and working that out, and working out some formulas would be very helpful into the living wage debate space and even into the minimum wage space. So I think that's important. So then clothing. Sure. For me, my view of clothing is a big hand clap. I think of clothing. I mean, what do you think clothing needs are of people? I think they must have at least one outfit for every single function. But, of course, you also need two outfits for some things as well, you know.
Because there's also so much dignity with clothing. Yeah. There's stigma. There's, you know, sometimes when you're that one kid that's got inherited clothes from their older siblings, and they're always, you know, you're always that kid with the old clothes.
Yeah.
It makes an impression on you, and your peers also perceive you as something. So again, like in terms of those psychological implications of clothing, where's the limit?
Especially for kids, eh?
It's very, very blurry. And I mean, we've just done a big clothing piece with domestic workers, where we got the first year students at UJ as part of their final assessment to redesign the domestic worker uniform.
Wow.
And really, that was, that exercise went beyond just the functionality. Yes, that was extremely important, that it be practical and durable and all those good things, as well as that it protects their bodies, right? Mm. But beyond that was an issue of stigma, which was an aesthetic. And what we realized was, because initially, I mean, you think aesthetic things are luxuries, but what we realized is that that domestic worker aesthetic that hasn't changed forever, right, has started to carry a certain stigma where it carries with it their position in our society and our image of them. And so they would talk about things like, you know, because of these clothes, when I go to shops, I don't receive the same service. Yeah. My kids are embarrassed to be seen with me. It's really hard to date because this uniform is the symbol of everything else.
It's almost like they're reminded of their limits every day, you know, what they cannot access because, you know, a lot of them plan to maybe just be in the job for about 6 months and 30 years later, they're still there.
Mm.
And so it becomes a constant reminder of what they were unable to access.
So they were like, can you just give us a more, a more dignified aesthetic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know? And
sure. So when I wrote my article, I wasn't thinking of those things. And I mean, this is it. This is, we're all on journeys, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I think, yeah.
No, I mean, I think it's important to first get clothes there to begin with. Yes, absolutely. So, and then we can discuss.
So yeah, just to say with food, shelter, clothing, all of those things are monetized. So, so working out for food 2000, shelter was this, clothing was this. And again, clothing, you have to, I suppose, how often do you buy an outfit? How often does a family need to buy various, what is your clothing budget? No, I won't ask that.
Oh, you are? Is that a...
Well, I think it's worth thinking about, actually, because I don't have one, which already shows my privilege. Because just whenever I feel like it, I get something.
Okay, I don't know about feel like it, girl. But it's almost...
No, but not in that sense. Like, in general, I don't particularly
it's whenever you can, right?
Buying clothes. But no, it's when I find something that I really don't want to leave behind that I get it.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but that's a luxury. Yeah. It's a complete luxury that I can do that.
Yeah.
But I don't often buy clothes. So it's not that I have a high budget for it at all.
Mm.
But it's, yeah, when.
So, I'd work out what is it that you think for a school uniform, for a winter outfit, for a summer outfit, for work clothes, for.
And considering how long they would last as well.
Et cetera. Work it out for the year.
Yeah.
And put that into a month, per month figure.
Mm-hmm.
Clothing, basic needs. For basic needs, what. So for me. A lot of our Christian convictions drove this. And I remember reading this on Living Wage out of Isaiah 58.
Mm.
And Isaiah 58 is this text that says, you live with your pleasures and you exploit your workers.
Mm.
It's almost, that's how it starts out. This is the kind of fast you've chosen. I've always read that text and thought, oh my goodness, it's about fasting and we must care for the poor when we're fasting. But it's actually about the worker... the worker-employer relationship.
Yeah.
And then it says, provide the wanderer with shelter. And then it goes through these five different areas. So it says, feed the hungry, provide the wanderer with shelter, clothing, it says, clothe the naked, says, satisfy the needs of the oppressed. And then it says, untie the cords of the yoke. So that was where I got those five budgeting areas from, was out of Isaiah 58.
Strong resonance there.
Because I felt that they were five areas that are important budget areas to meet. So when it came to basic needs in South African context, transport, you mentioned, how far does the person live from their place of work?
Yeah.
How much is transport going to cost? You look at people living, there was that couple that moved into Mamelodi for a month, and they did this budget of what they lived off. And they found they were spending one third of their income. They were trying to live off 2,000 or 3,000 rand a month. I can't remember what it was. But they spent one third of their income on transport. Mm. And, you know, people are spending 700, 800 rand a month on transport. So transport, cell phones, communication, school fees. What else would be basic needs that people would have? What are your basic needs that...
I guess school.
Toiletries, schooling.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I don't think about these things. I'm
you just go
myself.
Buy them. I must come and hang with you a bit more. Maybe you can
no, it's
that.
True. That, no, that but stumped because, me as well.
Yeah.
And it's because...
Because we have our comforts and we have our needs.
Because we have them.
Yeah.
You know, one way or the other. And by no means are either of us...
Electricity, water.
Yes.
Exactly.
See, this is the thing. I don't think about where I'm going to get my electricity or water from.
Just on the side, my housing company that I rent from in Hillbrow charges me 173 rand a month for sanitation. So I have to pay 173 rand a month to use the toilet in Hillbrow.
Oh,
that's amazing.
Just in addition to my rent.
Do you see what I'm saying? I just go.
I also just go until I look at the bowl. but there was a little bit of
you might need a schedule.
No, but each toilet
monitor
is,
your
is
fluid.
Charged for it gets a sanitation charge added onto my bill, you know.
Wow.
Does that make you monitor your fluids? I swear.
Oh, girl.
Okay, we're going to move.
Yeah.
So food shop.
No, I just think it's an interesting thing. No, let me make, I'm not being facetious. I actually think for me, going to the toilet is an inalienable right.
Yeah.
Mm. And if I had to pay, if I knew I had to pay to go, I might monitor my consumption.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. I might monitor how much I'm eating.
I think the municipality does charge everybody a cost for through your rates and taxes. So you get a sanitation charge, a water charge, an electricity charge that comes in your household, in your rates and taxes bill.
Yeah.
Now, but obviously, if you're living in a flat and you're renting, that thing gets divided into the number of flats that are there. It was just interesting. I saw it on the bill the other day.
But it's hugely important.
173 rand a day is what I'm paying for sanitation. 173 rand a month is what I pay for my... access to sanitation.
If you think about kids, there was a couple of years ago, I don't know if he was called like Dr. Toilet or something, but there was this guy, a social entrepreneur, who was trying to address sanitation in poor schools, right?
Yeah.
And how bad the toilets were and how actually it was affecting the kids and their productivity. It was affecting their consumption. So they wouldn't drink as much water. They wouldn't eat as much because they knew they couldn't use the loo. Girls would obviously stay away for long, you know.
Stay away from school.
During their menstrual cycle because that was an issue. So I actually think it is something that's hugely important.
Yeah, sanitation is a big thing. It is a fundamental human right. And you know, we've talked about eradicating bucket toilets, and you go to schools in these informal settlements, and you'll have a school with 1,000, 1,500 pupils, and they have six bucket toilets, and you think, how on earth do 1,000 people use six bucket toilets? It's just,
and the knock-on effects are amazing.
Yeah. Anyway, so food, shelter, clothing, basic needs, and then untying the cords of the yoke, or ensuring people can break out of poverty.
Okay.
So, in fact, there was a pope back at the turn of the 19th century, in 1898, who wrote a papal decree called Rerum Novarum, and he said that if a person earns a living wage, it should be enough that they can save a little to enable them to break out of poverty. I think that I don't know what you say, but my friends have always said 10% is a really good percentage to aim for savings. Maybe you save a lot more per month. But we want people to be able to put away some money for rough times.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, when you're living in poverty, crises happen on an ongoing basis.
Yeah,
so
you know, and actually I really like that you said that, because I do want to get a little bit into, you know, breaking the cycle of poverty, because it's not just about having money, but it's about knowing what to do once you have money.
Yeah.
And so understanding, you know, financial literacy, knowing how the system works, because unfortunately that's the system that they're in. But now when you have things like that, so you have your savings, but you have constant issues and your savings keep running dry or just, you know, keep being, used up. How can we aid in contributing to understanding how to, or what to better do with the money that we have, whether little or a lot?
I think you're asking the wrong guy. But,
it's a big question.
It's a big question. Sure. It is a big question. I think, yeah. Sure. And to go back to add to the question is, what can employers do in order to assist people to build resilience against these things?
Yeah.
So when your employees come to you all the time, the domestic workers come to you and saying, look, my child is getting kicked out of school and I have to go and sort out the school. Or I have to go to the child's school to investigate it and find, school fees are not being paid. Maybe we need to pay a bit more to make sure school fees are paid. Or, when there's problems that are happening, is to try and identify what are these systemic problems and work together with people in partnership to address them.
Because just why it's such a big issue in my head is because just a big issue in general, is when I first started doing my, you know, like practice in architecture. Now, I'm someone that has had access to higher education, to lecturers, to the networks. And it wasn't difficult for me to get jobs. But once I was there, there was still the impression that they would train the white people in ways that they weren't training us, you know, the black practitioners. There were things we just didn't know, and there were things we weren't privy to. And this is with us supposedly having access to knowing how the system works.
Yeah. Mm.
So that's why I'm wondering. So in spite of having the income or having the job or having exposure, how do we get through that?
Is education a big part of, I mean, the fifth cog was around
how to break out of generational poverty.
Yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of my friends have done things like set up educational trust funds. I think for white South Africans, it is something that we need to be doing in terms of restitution. I think education and so if you look at things that keep people in poverty, I think education is big. And then I think the other thing is access to finance.
Yeah.
And probably I still think one of the biggest things is a lack of access to connections.
Absolutely. So such a big thing in this country, my completely. Friend. Oh my God. And completely. Actually, based on what you've just said, was your experience now.
Yeah.
And what's remarkable about what you've done, right? Integrating yourself in Hillbrow. And taking that step before you ever sat down with Lois and tried to figure out what is a living wage, but simply opening up networks of opportunity.
So if my friends can meet your friends.
Absolutely.
And for me, so I think the first thing, if you want to help somebody who's trapped in poverty, and I think the first thing that we can do is share our connections.
Completely.
Which we don't do. That's the one thing we don't do. Mm. We almost do everything but that.
Essentially, at the heart of white privilege is connectedness. So what are we, so
the penny drop.
There we go. At the heart of our privilege is connectedness. So connectedness is, how do we share? So I've got a friend, Jethro, who I think you've met him.
Yeah, I have.
He's visually impaired. He's blind. He came across from Zimbabwe 2007 and he was begging on the streets for a living. And we became good friends. And eventually what I did was I brought one of my friends who was living in Bryanston, who's got his MBA, brought him in touch with Jethro, and they formed a friendship. And through that friendship, my friend Mike helped Jethro to start a business. He's now got a laundry going. They employ four people.
My goodness.
And it's just because I brought two people together. I didn't contribute any money into that. Well, I mean, we're always helping our friends together, aren't we? But when we bring friends together and we bring connections together, we break the back of poverty.
Yeah.
And I also just want to say on that, I want to put caution is that, I mean, as a white South African, and I'm talking a lot about whiteness, but
we love talking about whiteness.
Yeah, we do.
Don't worry.
Yeah. Whiteness, blackness,
all kinds of ness.
All that. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I think we need to be nice. So if you want to be white nice, what does that mean? We've got to move beyond our white savior mentality. We've got to kind of move beyond this patronizing, I'm here to solve poverty.
Absolutely.
I think that what we need to aim for in our relationships with people is equality. So the question is, how do I form equal relationships with people that are poor? So when we've moved into Hillbrow, one of the things is that's been a big question to us. We're always having conversations about how do I break down these barriers? And it's very difficult. There's barriers of class, there's barriers of race, there's barriers of nationality. Mm. There's all sorts of barriers, not only from my side, but from from Jethro's side, certainly there was a lot of stuff from both sides. And the question is, the truth that I've discovered is in Jethro is a gift for me that he's got an abundance of that I can learn from. And in me, there's an abundance in me that he can have. And when we share the abundance in
mutual.
Both of us, and we seek mutuality in our friendships and mutual equality. So I see him as a valuable person and I seek to learn from him. My friend who's worked, my friends is just an absolute hero of mine. Angie Barker, and worked amongst, lived in urban slums for, I don't know, 20 years. But she came to visit and I took her to go and meet Jethro. And the first thing she did was she said to Jethro, "Oh, I see you've got a braille," you know, Australian accent, I won't mimic it. But she said, "I see you've got a braille machine. Can I ask you if you could possibly write out my son's name for him? I would love to give it to him as a gift." Lovely. It was the first thing she did was to actually give him the dignity of helping her with something.
Right.
So that relationship was not founded on a top-down relationship, but an equal relationship.
I know, and it's absolutely amazing.
Sorry, I said there were three things. The one was share your connections.
Yes.
The second was in education. So that was the question you asked. So in terms of education, I think it's important that we, especially as white South Africans, if we committed to restitution, this is an area that we need to get involved in. And, you know, there's all sorts of trusts that people are setting up. Ask your friends, find out where there's a fund that you can invest into. If you're employing a domestic worker, look at investing into her or a person doing your gardening. Look if you can invest into the children in terms of their education. That's vital. And then the third is access to finance. So for the poor, access to finance is always a challenge. Our banks do not like people who
have no money.
And we can use our influence to assist people through surety or through through assisting them to access finance when they wanted to start businesses. Amazing. Those are three key things I think for white people in terms of restitution. But
And can you tell us what you told me about Lois, because you said that she's no longer with you, but what happened as a result of where she's gone?
So we kind of came to the conclusion as a family that for financial reasons, but also because I think we became convinced that we could fold our own underwear.
It occurred to you.
that it is an incredibly privileged life to live with somebody who's serving you. And I think that if we are going to live in solidarity with most South Africans, we've got to move out of the space of privilege and getting people to work for us and to just treat and make our lives so we did things like we got our kids involved with doing household chores and I'm still, if anybody's got advice, please email me on how to get my kids to clean their rooms and make their beds and do those things.
Gotta pay them a living wage.
There we go. That is it. But, yeah. I don't know. We've tried all sorts of tricks, but we're learning that that's what people around the world do. You know, South Africa, it's because we've got cheap exploitable labor that we employ people in this, but also for financial reasons and wanting to just live more in solidarity with people in our community, we decided that Lois needed to, not have a domestic worker anymore. So we spoke to Lois about it, and we went through a whole retrenchment process. And I said to Lois, you know, we would pay her that retrenchment package. But during that process, I also said I would commit to helping her find another job. And then that's sharing your connections, you know.
Yeah.
So I contacted. I mean, it's very quick. If you are white, middle-class South African, to organize somebody a job is possible, you know?
Yeah.
And especially somebody as amazing as Lois. So I contacted a friend at Been There Coffee Company. And if I could ever plug a company as being the most amazing company on the planet, it would be Been There Coffee
Company.
Where
is it?
Been There Coffee, 44 Stanley, 111 Smith Street.
Oh, wow.
Cape Town as well. I love coffee.
So
their coffee is fair trade coffee. So
got it.
So their value system, the value chain of Been There is all about
coffee and values.
their values is they source, it's single origin African coffees. It's coffees from, and they work with farmers to ensure sustainability. Mm. They make sure that farmers get paid a living. A fair trade prices for the coffee. So there's the value chain all the way down is making sure that there's justice in this supply chain of the coffee. So my friend had been there, employed Lois, and they also read my article that I wrote on the living wage, and they shared it with their directors, and they've decided that everybody in that company gets paid a living wage now.
Oh, my goodness.
So I think that if there ever was a reason to go to a company and drink coffee, that would be the reason.
I'm on it.
Because it's just coffee. I mean, you need just coffee. So I think the values, I think lots of companies should begin to just take the plunge and say, we're going to change the way every single employee in our company is going to get paid a living wage. This whole stuff at Fees Must Fall at Wits.
Mm.
I don't know if you spoke to any of the ground staff or cleaning staff at Wits. You know, they've now, at first it was 5,000. I think it's more now.
Mm.
It was 4,500 was their first. I mean, it was significantly more than what people were earning.
Mm.
Suddenly, it's transformed lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, Wits likes to say, oh, it's cost X million or whatever. But when you compare it to their overall budget of the company, of how much it's actually, overall budget of the university, it's a very small percentage increase in the overall budget of the university that's been given so that people can have a living wage. It's just insane that we've been doing outsourcing and we've justified it because it's cheaper for the university. But when you look at what it is in terms of an overall percentage of just making sure people get paid a living wage or get paid an acceptable minimum wage.
Do you have any connection to the Living Wage website that's now opened? Have you seen it?
Which one?
There's a Living Wage website.
Livingwage.org.za. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, living-wage.co.za.
Okay, so that is a company called Code SA that is in Cape Town.
Mm.
And they did a living wage calculator.
Mm.
The way they've calculated it, they worked with one of the Wits poverty research institutes that had a basket of goods, and they worked with them to work out costs. So it's a good calculator to go to.
Okay, I tried it.
Yeah.
Is it in any way different
from
the way that you worked out? Do you have any idea?
I'm not familiar 100%. We actually are starting a living wage website, which hopefully will be up in the next 6 months. But we've spoken to them about putting that calculator onto our website. Having said that, the living wage website has used data that's about 3 or 4 years old now.
Okay.
So we need to be aware that, I mean, Stats SA, I think the last So that SA survey was 2011, was it, or 2014?
Sure. Yeah.
So we've still got quite old economic data. It needs to be updated, and websites like that need to be updated. So, and also, they don't look at individual families in the website. They look at things like.
Statistically, you would need this much for transport.
Right. Yeah.
So it is helpful to sit down and have a conversation with somebody and to say, let's look at your budget and to review that over a couple of months.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And with that, I mean, wow.
Wow. I have literally very little left to say. I mean.
Yeah, you can go into the thought of the day.
I don't even know. it might just be like overstimulus, but no. I think actually the thought of the day.
Or it might be think about everything that Nigel just said.
Exactly. No, without really going into it, because I think we have in so many ways, or maybe not. But injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And that's what Martin Luther King Jr. said. And I think it is just absolutely poignant, given where our conversation started, which was just, I think, a general overview of our moral fabric from an economic and a social point of view, and then to honing in on the living wage of domestic workers in particular. But it certainly isn't just about domestic workers. It's about our principles as a society. And, you know, like you pointed out, the situation that mine workers are in and the situation that domestic workers are in is very much related. And I think there's multiple links we can point to, but it's just that greater consciousness, I guess, that you realize when you as an individual decided to do something. It's like greater consciousness that what we do in a silo actually has a ripple effect.
Wow. Yeah, thanks for connecting the dots. Even, I mean, for myself, and I think every time I talk to you, you ask me something I've never thought about. So it's really good to, you know, continue to have these sorts of discussions. I mean, and I think you're quite an advocate for discussing engagements, dialogue, whether hard or not. And so, yeah, we really, really appreciate you coming.
What a treat.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you both for the show. And I think it's very inspiring to be part, to just have been on a show that is committed to these issues, you know, a show for domestic workers and a show around domestic workers and their rights and justice. I mean, it's very inspiring. I think the key for me with transforming South Africa is that every single one of us is on a journey, and let's try to be more authentic in our journey, and let's try to just carry on doing a little bit more each day until we see the whole universe bending towards justice. You know?
Oh, wow. Thank you so much, Nigel. And thank you guys for listening to the Medecisions on cliffcentral.com. You can follow us on
Twitter at MadeProject. I was going to say .com. Sorry. Just at Made Project. That's MAIDE Project, as well as the Made Sessions on Facebook. Thanks again so much, Nigel. I think you rounded up the show very well. Have a good evening, everyone.
Cheers.
Bye. Cliffcentral
Revolution. I've got something important to tell you.
Cliffcentral.com. Cliffcentral.com.